Hello and welcome to another episode of 10,000 Hours, or should I say 10,000 Miles. This is a special episode of 10,000 Hours where we take the show on the road. Currently, we're broadcasting from Portland, Oregon. You may have heard of
Absolutely.
It. Absolutely. If you haven't, that's pretty stupid.
Look it up. It's a major U.S. city.
It is, yeah. Please. I mean, come on. And this episode is our second in the installment of 10,000 Miles.
Yep.
This is episode 26.
That's right.
26. And we're talking to Evan.
Evan Schneider.
P. Schneider. Evan P. Schneider.
Evan P. Schneider. Author, kind of aggregator of
biker
information. Yes, and avid cyclist. And so this is kind of the lens through which he views his work. And we talked about, on this episode, A to B. And I'll explain that in a second, or I'll have you help me explain it.
Well, because we started at A, right? And then Where do we end up?
We end up at B.
At B, okay, yeah.
Like always. And you might know Evan from his published works, one being the novel A Simple Machine Like the Lever, which was a great
lever.
Book. Lever, lover, let's call the whole thing off.
Potato, potato.
That's right, exactly. And his series of cycling handbooks and field guides called Bone Shaker, the Bone Shaker series. He was an awesome conversation, very enlightening guy, and the discussion about A to B kind of lends itself well to someone who is avid in traveling and cycling.
Well, yeah, so there's like the travel aspect and also like the idea of starting and finishing a novel.
Exactly.
Which is like kind of mind-boggling to me, but also like understandable, but also like, wow.
Yeah. And his story about how that came to pass is very unique.
Super cool. Thank you, Evan. And thank you to Green Room Magazine, something I am a part of.
Friend of the show.
Sweet friend of the show.
And this week's sponsor.
And this week's sponsor of the podcast. And actually, you know, by airtime, it'll be probably a few weeks until this is live. But
yeah.
We're dating it now. We're dating it. But mid-September, this is 2014, for all of you people who are listening back 3 or 4 years into the podcast.
Buy stock in Bitcoin, please. Do yourself a favor.
Yeah, so thank you, Green Room Magazine, for supporting this episode of the podcast, and also for supporting this venture, which was 10,000 Miles. And we have a spread in the upcoming, or the old coming,
depending on when you're listening to this, yes.
Issue of Green Room Magazine. So that'll be dropping in mid-September 2014.
Yep.
And we have a little spread for 10,000 Hours and for the people we met with, which is super exciting. And
yeah, you can read all about our Grant's trip and the conversations we had and the opinions that our guests had about home and what it means to them. And I think it's going to be awesome. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be so good. And I think just to bring this on home to B. So we started at A with this intro, right?
And now we're at B. Thank you, Green Room, for your sponsorship. And thank you, listeners, for listening. I hope you enjoy it.
Start at the start or just start from the start at the end? Why not, right?
Yeah, dude. It reminds me of this old parable I heard once. There's a young, impatient man waiting at the bus stop with this old guy. And the bus is late. And he's like, then he finally sees the headlights on the horizon. And he exclaims, finally, the bus is coming. And the old man says to him, the bus was always coming.
Sweet baby Vince, do you just want to start us off and tell us what you're putting your hours into right now? Or your minutes? What are your units of time? And I guess I don't know how you record those. What
I only record in moons.
Okay.
So I'm putting my moons. Now that actually sounds really
it's a waning cycle right now. Yeah, well. Yeah.
Are we in the wane? Yeah. Are we waning right now?
I have an app for that.
Here's this crazy thing on the, in the podcast world. I can, when the guest talks without being introduced, I can't even hear it. So I didn't even hear anything. Did you hear anything?
No. What was that strange? But what I'm putting my time into right now is this Samsung work at Yamamoto at my office. Today it was music finding, which is always an interesting foray.
Is that like geocaching? Is that the same thing?
It feels similar sometimes in that it's hopeless. But basically, you scour the internet's free music sources, which I have to say, I'm very impressed with the amount of work that some of these audio producers put into like making free or cheap to use online audio. But despite the high quality of the stuff, it never, you can never find like the track that is right.
You know what you should do? You should go to somewhere custom. I'm going to give a shout out to Egg Music, who, friends of the show, I'm a big fan of them. That's what you guys should be doing. I don't want to tell you guys how to do your job, but
no,
you're working on the next big thing, right?
I agree that ideally that's what we do, but we have like a day. We have like 24 hours to do it. So. C'est la vie. But yeah, that's kept me busy today. And of course, the show. It's a busy week for the show.
The busiest week for the show ever.
especially for you, man. Who, if you want to introduce that, while I ask you what you've been
So I'm coming to you live alive. I am alive from Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine.
In its own right, but that's not where
part of the special 10K road trip, 10,000 miles. I don't know what we're calling it anymore, but we're on the road recording some casts. This is our third this week, I think. I don't know. It's hard to keep track. Not to say that each one is not an individual and beautiful and unique butterfly.
Snowflake.
Yes, snowflake butterfly. Well, it's super hot out. There's no way it's a snowflake. So, yeah, I'm on the road. I'm working on that. I'm working on actually, like, well, that music video still, which is, like, crazy, trying to scout from afar and cast some people. So that's been, like, a hell of an experience. Also working on, like, a top secret project that I told you about a while ago that we'll connect on that off the show. But I think that's something I can share soonish. So pretty crazy.
Stay tuned. This is going to be cool in a couple weeks. We're going to hear about this.
Word. So doing that and currently, like at the moment, exactly right now, I'm putting my time into the podcast because we're on the we're recording this.
Yep, we are recording right now. So, and
speaking of, who are we recording with, Vince?
We're recording with Evan Schneider. Am I saying that right?
Absolutely.
I was hoping you would do this like a big build up, like you may know him from. He's the man. but you just went right for the name, which I respect, actually.
So I'm going name and then introduction. He is an author and cycling enthusiast, if I'm not too bold as to say. He's written a couple things you might have heard of, one being A Simple Machine Like the Lever, if that's the correct title, I think. I just read it, so I should know. And the Bone Shaker series of bicycling almanacs, both of which have gotten great reviews and are great reads. I'm holding a copy of one of the almanacs right now.
You should have sent it with me. I could have got it signed.
You know, in retrospect, that would have been pretty sweet, actually.
You messed up.
I dropped the ball, as usual. but yes, Evan P. Schneider, as it says on his website, thank you very much for joining us. I'm excited to talk to you, and it's been a long time coming. Please do me the honor of telling me what you've been putting your time into recently.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show here in the very, very, very warm Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
It's only this warm about 2 weeks out of the year. So
we're sweating hard.
This is one of those 2 weeks. But anyhow, that is what I'm putting my effort into right now, is sweating profusely. Mm-hmm. But that's my body doing that without me asking.
Wow.
But so what I'm asking my body to do and my mind to do of late is really kind of double down on the idea of self-preservation, self-sufficiency. I just made a really, really bold step. I told you before the show I was working for the past 4 years at this nonprofit literary organization here in Oregon, and I was their communications manager, handling all their print collateral and their website and their social media. But I decided it was time to really try to make a go of it on my own, strike out on my own, see what I could do. Mm-hmm. As you noted, A Simple Machine Like the Lever is a novel that I wrote that's out in the world now, and I decided there should be a sibling for that book. So that sibling isn't going to happen without some work on my end. It's it's not tied to that book in any way, shape, or form, but it's just another one that I'm creating. It's
Evan, are you telling me that writing a novel isn't easy? Is that what you're trying to say?
Oh, come on.
It may certainly be for some people. It is not for me in any way, shape, or form.
Diplomatic answer. Nice. I like
I'm curious, though. So it's a sibling, but it's not related. Is this an adopted child?
No, it's just that I am the parental unit of this book.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's been a good 3 years since my novel came out, and I've had really high hopes for a short story collection. So I have about six pretty polished stories, one of which I read last night at a local reading series called Tell It Slant, which was pretty amazing turnout, really great reading series.
Was it at Powell's?
This one was not at Powell's. It was at
That's the bookstore here.
That is the biggest, I think, independent in the country, other than maybe The Strand.
I was just being a tourist. For a second.
Everybody wants to know where Powell's is.
Yeah, yeah.
They have their big map and they say, which way is the Powell's?
Where's the Powell's?
Which way is the Powell's?
It is a really cool store, though.
It is amazing. And yeah. They're undergoing a really cool renovation right now.
A side note, I'm a big fan of, my favorite author in the whole world is Chuck Palahniuk.
He lives right around this neighborhood right
fuck
behind
off.
You. I kid you not.
Fuck the fuck off.
He's like right
I'm sorry
you.
For swearing like that. But I'm a real, real big fanboy. Like he's pretty much the reason for most of my creative work.
I would dare say that he is within 2 miles of your physical being at this moment.
Oh baby. Hey Grant, what do you think of Fight Club 2, the graphic novel that's coming out in the not so distant future?
Shut your mouth. There is no such thing.
Yeah, it's real.
Wow.
I'm super intrigued by it. I mean, it's like definitely a thing he's wanted to do. And it's kind of like his interplay between a movie and a book, sort of. And I don't know. It's going to be cool. I'd prefer a book.
I am too. I'm kind of excited to see his take on this medium.
Mm-hmm.
It's a medium I've enjoyed in the past, but I think I'm cautiously optimistic is how I would describe it.
Yeah.
Do you know with whom he is working on this?
I forget. No, I'm not sure.
No, I just saw Chucky P's name, and I was my eyes glazed over.
they were doing some big announcements as Comic Con, times. But he talked about that a little bit because I went and saw him when he was on his last book tour, and it's gonna be cool. I mean, it's I'm not mad. I really want a book though. I want a book.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm a real traditionalist. not really.
Nah.
But speaking of the process of bookmaking or of creation, I mean creative work. One could say creation was creative work. We don't have to go down that path.
I mean, we probably should not. But yes, speaking of processes more than anything, right? Speaking of journeys from beginning something to completing it, from starting a book to finishing it to starting the next one. Today, we are talking about A to B, the creative journey as it pertains to our projects.
A to B. It is. I mean, we've talked sort of in different shades about that before. We've talked about the project lifespan. We've talked about sort of the creative journey in a different way. But I think what really inspired this topic is thinking about the process of making a novel. And I think the process of, shipping a novel and then where do you go from there? So I would just be really curious to hear Evan's take on A to B and maybe even just telling us about the experience of writing your first novel. Where did that start and what would that process look like and where did it, quote unquote, finish if it did? I mean, yeah. It did. I know it did, but is a book ever really finished?
I really like that question because especially in consideration of these two projects, one, the novel that's already finished and is already out, and then this new collection that is not out really in any way, shape, or form. Those processes have been very different. For the A to B, B to A, do you start somewhere in the middle? Are you already on the journey before you even know you are sort of? Mm-hmm. Sort of question. When I started that novel, probably back in 2009, I did so at the sort of request of an editor. So I really, a book editor. And so I arguably may have started at B instead of A, because B, maybe in the publishing cycle, you get to the editor and you get to the publication stage. But I had this very good friend, and he was in my writing group, and he's been a peer of mine for a long time, and he had started this publishing company, and he said, you had wanted to write a book. And I said, yes. And he said, you should begin to write that book. And I said, well, I don't know about that. I don't think I'm ready to write that book. And he said, well, never mind that. Why don't you write me the first chapter and send it to me? And I said, okay, I'll do that. So I sent him the first chapter, and he said, excellent, write me the second chapter and send it to me. So what we did
you
was
just
we
coerced into
you
doing
tricked
it.
You into
was,
writing
was,
a book.
I was coerced into writing and publishing my first novel, which I could not be more thankful for, because then, as I'll get to in this short-lived story, it changed drastically when then I started my second project. I knew from the get-go what it was that I wanted to accomplish with that book, and there was no coercion needed to start that one. But in this first process, he tricked me into writing all of these chapters, and what we did was we opened up these secret Tumblr sites where just he and I had the passwords.
Oh, okay.
And
they meant secret Tumblr sites in your mind, like
no.
The seven chakras.
No, we just set up. I said, "Hey, there's a new chapter up," and it was privates only. And I could see it, and so it wasn't searchable. Thank God, so no one can see these atrocious first drafts.
Sure.
So in any case, he said, "Awesome, awesome, awesome," and at every point he said, "Perfect. What's the next chapter? What's the next chapter? What's the next chapter?" So I enrolled all of the chapters, and I said, I think that's maybe what I have for you. And he said, perfect. Now we can start over and really write the book. Like, we can look at the narrative arc. We can
back to A.
Yeah,
back to A, right?
He basically, like, he forced some Ipecac down your throat and had you puke up a draft without you knowing it.
Right. Because it was secret, I was just, the stakes were extraordinarily low. All I had to do was churn out what I thought was a pretty good draft. And a lot of those chapters never made it in the book, thankfully. But he never said that. He never said, oh, that's a terrible, terrible chapter. He just said,
right,
perfect.
Right.
Keep going. Because he knew at some point if we had a draft, then we could dial it back and get to the good stuff.
So I guess what do we... I guess obviously that first draft, that's somewhere between the points of A and B, right? Although to you, did it seem like you were like at B when you got the first draft out, or pretty close?
I mean, I felt like I was at B because I was exhausted.
Yeah.
I was emotionally drained. I had lived this thing with my character for almost 2 years, and I thought, yes, I finally have reached this point where I think, in my mind, the narrative had done what I had wanted it to do, though in retrospect, there was at least half of the work still to do. But yeah, I felt like I was at B. If not at B, I was at A.5 or whatever it is, halfway,
right.
You know?
So how long did the first draft take? And then...
It seemed like a good year to get the first draft done, and then the editing... And the rewrite and that kind of went pretty quickly. It was under a year, and then we were to press with it.
Wow!
So it was within 2 years. It's not Gone with the Wind. It's brief and it's digestible. Vince, you read it probably in an afternoon or a couple sittings.
Two evenings, I think.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just wanted to get something out there that was. I appreciate books that I can read and then feel like I've accomplished something instead of like, oh my God, I'm never going to get through this book. It's going to go on forever.
Titanic.
I'll never get to be.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was the editorial process was a little bit quicker, and we got it to press in about 2.5 years.
Nice.
Like an extremely fascinating way to go about it, because that's not what you hear usually, right? You hear that the novelist or the author has like, worked on it, slaved over it for years in secret, and is obsessed over it, and then unsuccessfully ports it to every publisher in the country world.
Hundreds of rejection letters later.
Exactly. And then finally, you know, someone takes a chance on it and it works out. But this seems to be like almost the exact opposite. Your publisher, this friend of yours kind of knew that you had this novel in you and coaxed it out of you. That's just very cool. And I'm glad that it's an unorthodox story, if I may be so bold as to say that, because it gives a good framework for the fact that when we're talking about from A to B, it's anything but a prescriptive process, right? Everybody's journey from the start of a project to the end of the project is different. And every project is going to be different in that regard.
And you know what? I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my editor's name, Dan DeWeese, who started nice. Propeller Books, because he is the most phenomenal editor I've ever known or worked with, quite luckily. And he has done this with several other writers in the country. He has taken pieces that were good to start with, but then made them extraordinarily, and really helps writers get to A to B and then launch into more. He's really, really selfless and is excited to see you take your journey.
Awesome to hear. Good. Well, show notes him.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, what a gift. What a gift to have somebody like that as like a catalyst in your process and as somebody to hold you accountable and to kind of guide you, your book
companion
shaman.
Companion on the journey. Oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. Your book shaman. I love that. Nice. Nicely done. Great.
Hey, thanks, man. Yeah, no, I've been thinking about that for a few weeks. I've been planning on dropping that in. I was just waiting for the...
He has it written down here, I see.
Say, stop it. But, you know, that kind of got me thinking like about perceptions of A and B. And thinking about Evan's perception of finished or of B, which was off. I mean, not by any fault of his own, but that was just his view was, oh, yes, okay, I've arrived, I'm here. But it seems like that's kind of something we often come back to talking about, which is that your expectation or your perception is just never really going to match up. And oftentimes it's sort of off base. And I would actually argue, and I think about this a lot, is... your perception of A is often much, much further back than it really, I mean, your perception is farther ahead than you actually realize. So I'm guessing for Evan, A was not the first chapter. Like A was like 10 years ago, right? A was whatever, not every single event, but kind of like that led up to that moment. So tell us about the book a little bit, and I'm like, I'd be curious to hear where the chapter came from, where the book came from, and what was the like sort of true A moment of it.
I really like that idea quite a bit, and I would maybe even loop in the idea of the false summit. I don't know if you've ever been hiking, but if you're peak climbing, maybe when you start back at A and you're at the trailhead, you can see Mount Bierstadt in the distance. You know where you're headed. You can clearly see B. But as you start to hike and you get into the forest and you get closer to the peak, you're like, oh, I can see the top. It's right there. Uh-huh. And you work very, very hard to get there. And then you get to the top of that. And then you see, oh, no, the peak is actually
it's sort
further
of like
beyond.
Exponential.
Yes,
like,
because you can't see past this hill in front of you. Uh-huh. Only until you get on top of the hill do you see, oh, this actually isn't the top. I'm quite a bit further away than I actually thought I am. So they call it a false summit.
What a delightful metaphor.
I like it quite a bit. And then you say, backing up and wondering where point A was in this project. I, for a very long time, have liked the writing of a particular Maine author named Nicholson Baker. And he he writes three different types of books, is what I usually tell people. One is what I say is miniaturism, where he takes really commonplace, everyday experiences and then kind of puts a microscope over them with this really, really beautiful writing. And just takes it slow and takes it thoughtfully, everything from the quilted pattern on a paper towel to feeding a duck an ice cube, that sort of stuff. That'll be an entire chapter in one of his books.
Wow.
That's one type of book he writes. He's also he's a strong proponent of pacifism, so he has a couple nonfiction books about that. And then he also has another category that I call sexy books. He writes kind of soft core porn fiction that's literary fiction.
Like 10 to 15 Shades of Grey.
That is exactly right. He has the distinct honor of having authored the book that Monica Lewinsky gifted to President Clinton.
Wow.
And it's called Vox.
That is basically a historical artifact level of notoriety.
It is. And the book itself it's a pretty short novel. It's under 200 pages. And the entire thing is one or two phone conversations between a middle-aged man and a phone sex operator. And he calls for conversation. He doesn't call for, I mean, he wants the other thing too, but, just to watch this phone conversation unfold. Anyway, I like Nicholson Baker a lot, and one of his first novels was called The Mezzanine. And really, the narrative arc is a man breaks his shoelace and needs to go buy new shoelaces at lunch. And that is the entirety of the novel. And it, before David Foster Wallace, before a lot of these guys, he used really lengthy and prolific footnotes in this relatively simple narrative arc.
What I like about that is I consider that sort of like layering, right? It's like if I was to look at a painter, it's like, you know, it's just a whole nother layer, whether maybe that's like texture, maybe it's something else. It's such an interesting way to like break up the narrative and to like talk to you in a different. Are you familiar? I mean, this is like young adult stuff, but I read this like back in the day, like I think it's pronounced Bartimaeus trilogy.
Huh, I have not.
Oh, no, exactly. Okay. But anyway, just lots of like footnotes from the voice of the narrator.
There you go.
Super interesting.
So I was really into the mezzanine, as was Dan, my friend, my editor. And he said, you know what you should do? Let's write homages to the mezzanine, a book that's like the mezzanine, that is thoughtful, that takes this everyday occurrence like riding your bicycle to work and really breaks it down into these almost thought experiments of what's going on in your mind, what's happening, how is the crank rotating, how is the pedal catching in a certain spot. And he said, just write mm-hmm. an homage to Nicholson Baker without him knowing it. So that was where it started. But that I read that book probably close to 15 years ago, and I had read his other book since then. And I said, if I ever could meet or talk to or write a book for Nicholson Baker, I want to do that. And mm-hmm. so that's how it kind of started. So yeah, the A was probably way back there when I first thought that's the sort of book I want to write.
That's interesting. That's like, you know, when I think about, and Vince, I don't know if I've like shared much of this stuff with you, but like my early writing, especially like short story stuff, was very, very Polanyi-esque.
No, I've never had the pleasure, man.
Oh, man, yeah, well, you should remind me. I'll send you some stuff. But, yeah, that's like, definitely where it comes from is, like, and it's like, all you, it's, like, looking back, I thought I was, even then, like, as I progressed, I thought I was getting further from it, but I was like, oh, no, this is, like, so obviously that voice that I was just pulling. But
right, right.
But, I mean, I guess that's a lot of, especially when we think about creatives, that's where a lot of the path starts.
I mean, for me, there's like two different ways of looking at it. In one kind of hyperbolic full extension way, every project we've ever started and will ever start is a product of our influences, right? And our inspirations and our past products, and everything is just building off of the things we've done before and our like interests and influences. But on the other point, I think there is like a moment where you maybe decide that you might want to do something or that you will do something. And that's kind of an actual genesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've addressed this on the show before. When someone comes up to us, you, I know, have had this experience, or at least I think you have. People ask you, how do I start something? Starting something is hard. But the fact of the matter is, to an extent, asking that question, how do I start this thing, means that you've already started it. You want to do it. And that's maybe the most important step in the process
research,
of starting
something.
That's yeah, like... exactly. Desire, passion, even having the idea in the first place.
The tickle.
So, yeah, exactly. So maybe don't make such a big deal about having to start it because you've already started it, whether you want to or not. But I guess that's where I mean, I know you mentioned it earlier that your coworker prompted you, or your editor prompted you to start writing this chapter by chapter, but was there a time in which you had kind of decided to yourself that you were going to someday, at some point, write a novel about the subject matter that you ended up writing about?
Well, even to take a step back and then lead into that, I think, is like, I was just thinking about even the moment when I started to call myself a writer, which is kind of, okay, like where anything you write, then that's like at least a soft A. So
yeah,
I'm just kind of curious,
sure.
Where, at what point did you decide you were a writer?
That is a very, very funny question, because nowadays, I mean, I have a published novel that's been optioned for film. I'm working on a next book. Like I have the, if any time in my life I could say I'm a writer, it's now. But I'm probably more reluctant now to say that I'm a writer than I ever was. In fact, back when I got out of undergrad, I had an English degree and a teaching certificate. So I got my first job teaching public high school English. And I remember I started every class. God, I hope one of those students is listening to this. Those students are probably now, God, 30 years old or something. But Anyway, I said, I'm Mr. Evan Schneider, and I am not a teacher. I am a writer. I told them that, like, I was trying to assert.
Oh, my gosh, I love it.
Yeah, so here I am, this English teacher. God, I was 22 or something like that. And I'm like, I'm not a teacher, I'm a writer, but I have to make a living, so I'm going to teach for now.
Oh, my gosh. Right?
And so I said wow. that then, even though, God, what was I writing? I don't know. I had journals, or I had these half-assed, shitty short stories that weren't even finished, but I was convinced at that age I was a writer. Then as I got further into writing, I'm like, I am so far from being a writer that I'm not a writer at all. This is embarrassing. And even now, it's so hard to introduce yourself as, what do you do? And you say, I'm a writer. That just comes with a lot of skepticism or weird questions
it
that
sure
kind of
does,
surround
man.
It.
It sure does.
So anyway.
I totally respect that. Although my pushback would be, and I mean, not for everyone, but I think of, sorry, pop filter fell down here. I think my friend, Katie Ryan, who will tell you now that she's a fashion illustrator. For many, many months, for a year, whatever, she did not say that. And I know that there was sort of a critical moment that she decided to sort of own it and start calling herself that. And I think that as much as you, I think you probably respect the title of writer so much, and you and I think a lot of creatives in general kind of deal with this imposter syndrome. I'm not saying that's necessarily what you're going through, but it's like, I don't know. I can appreciate owning it. And I found that almost like owning it requires or forces you to sort of own it then in your life. And if you own it as your quote unquote title, then you sort of strive to live that life. At least personally, in my experience. And so I've found that once I start calling myself something, then I'm like so scared that I'm going to be found out that I then begin to become it, like very seriously. I mean, for example, director. I started adding director recently because I've been working on more film projects, and that's what I want to be doing. And now, you know, I'm directing my first thing. I'm directing a couple of things. And so I am, right? Yeah. And as long as I own that and I be that, then I am it.
And there's so many great quotes from really, really famous writers that say, are you writing? Did you write something? Then you are a writer.
Sure.
And I'm like, well, yeah, that's true.
But
and then I wonder, too, the parse, because I look at colleagues' bios, and some people call themselves writers, and then other people call themselves authors.
Oh,
and
boy.
I'm like, well, am I an author? Well, I guess I did author this book, but would I ever say to somebody, I'm an author? I don't know. Do you call yourself an author, or does somebody else call you an author? And
well,
so I mean, it's somewhat objective.
I think something published, kind of, right?
Vince, you're going to have to answer us.
When, like, is there an objective answer of when you are or are not an author?
Yeah.
I would have to say no, right? I mean, I'm a big opponent of anything objective, though.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Somewhat objective, though. More quantifiable than most things.
I mean, to an extent, though, I agree with you, Grant. Like, there's a certain point at which you're saying objective because it's going to be, like, fundamentally understood by the general public, right? So, like, if I've written one short story and I sincerely believe I'm an author, even though that story hasn't been published, and I go and say to someone on the street, I'm an author, they're going to have, like, a disproportionate belief in what that means. So I think at that point, the definition has some real meaning. And if you're a published author, then I think it's pretty easily understood that you're an actual author, to use that in air quotes. But
yeah, I'm going to back up now. I think, you know what, I don't think we should put gratification or qualification in the hands of anyone but ourselves. So if you want to call yourself an author, I think you're an author.
You know, the classic faint strategy for
Grant.
He overextends, he gets me to acquiesce a little bit, and then he retreats, and now I'm left stranded.
You know what Ernest Hemingway quote I'm reminded of is, he had once said, the more that somebody talks about their writing, the worse it probably is.
Seriously, dude.
And the best writers usually say nothing about their writing. And so I always think to myself, never say anything about my writing.
Oh my gosh. But actually, I'm going to push back on Ernesto here for
a second.
And say that that's a terrible philosophy, because a healthy amount of self-promotion is, I think, necessary for a good work to flourish. Because, I mean, you can't just expect things to be discovered on their own merits all the time, 100% of the time, right?
No, and you can't, especially now, like you have to put out there, hey, everybody, I did this thing. And people, I had a friend last night that I didn't really tell anybody that I was going to be reading at this reading series. I put it on Facebook or whatever, and I figured, well, if somebody's going to come, they're going to come, but I don't want them to.
Yeah.
I mean, just because you're my friend doesn't mean you need to come listen to me read my new short story.
Sure, sure.
But I was told, why didn't you tell me? And I was like, well, you are
for
here,
sure,
so you must have found out somehow. And also, that's embarrassing for me to have to tell you to come. Sort of.
Oh, see, there's... Okay,
but why should it be? But why should it be, right?
That's, yeah.
I think it's like...
That's a whole other show topic.
Disease of modesty that some of us have, and I know that I have it, especially being raised in the Midwest. Sometimes you feel that, like, an excessive amount of humility is a good trait, and that you shouldn't have to brag, or you don't even want to brag. You feel kind of put out to brag to your friends and to ask them to come and support you. That doesn't sound like a very, you know, friendly, selfless
sure.
thing to do. But I think more people would definitely be served to just be very upfront with the fact that, hey, I think this thing I'm doing is really cool, and it would mean the world to me if you'd come watch and support me in doing it.
Well,
and
I don't think
that's a conflict of interest.
I think that's there are two things here. Like that, especially when we talk about like the business of creativity and the business that we're in, even if our businesses are slightly different, they're similar. You know, it is, there's a business side to it that a lot of creatives fail at. And as much as the art is the most important thing, if you can't support yourself, then your art oftentimes suffers or it never gets seen. And I mean, it depends on what you want to do with it, but I think most artists strive to have their work seen, right? But what I was going to say was kind of along those same lines, and I'm thinking about this in the lens of like A to B of like, this is part of a process. And part of a process for me, and I think for most people, is like getting
Absolutely.
Feedback on a work before you push it out, whatever that means. That could be publishing something, that could be filming something, that could be, you know, whatever. But this is an interesting thing, and I'd be curious to hear your views on it. And I know, I'm thinking about, okay, so there are writers groups where you can go and get feedback, and that's mm-hmm. like a beautiful space. But I even think about, like when you were talking about Ernest Hemingway and then also the idea of just like talking about your writing, I find that sometimes, and I'm still trying to like figure out exactly why I'm feeling this way, but sometimes I have people talking to me about their projects and like I'm excited about them, but they want feedback. And like, that's like part of my job kind of, right?
Absolutely.
And
okay.
So yeah. There's this like interesting dichotomy or this interesting like event that happens with this, because there are some people who absolutely they're like in my wheelhouse of like, yeah, please ask for feedback, and I go to certain people for feedback. But there are other people who ask me for feedback and I'm just like, that's like what that's like a job to me, and I'm honestly not getting anything out of this. It's just like a lot of energy I'm putting into a thing. So I think we don't have to go too far down that rabbit trail, but more importantly, I guess, is just the idea of like feedback in your creative process. And I guess, I don't know what that looks like for you. I know you had an editor.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, where did he come from? He was your friend, but he's from your writing group, right?
You know, I met him when I lived in Colorado, and he's from Colorado also. And he had, he's a few years older than me, so he had already finished his degree, and then he moved out to L.A., and he was in the film business. So
classic story.
Exactly. He went to film school. He went to USC. Top of his class, like great, great film student, works for Michael Douglas for a little while, then decides he's going to become an English teacher, moves back to Colorado. I meet him there.
But
in...
when he got to the class, he said, I'm a filmmaker.
I'm a writer, not a teacher.
Yeah.
No, that was all me.
Okay.
He wouldn't do that.
I thought you learned that from him. Okay.
I met him in one of my classes when I was still an undergraduate. They told him if he was going to teach English, he had to get, I think, a couple more classes or something before he could get his certificate. So then he got looped into these undergrad classes, right? And he was the coolest fucking dude in the class because he was reading his New Yorker and he's just sitting there, and I'm like, man,
smoking a cigarette inside in a leather jacket, and it's just, the fire alarm's going off.
And so then when he gets up and he has to do anything like read one of his stories, it's just by far the best story in the entire class. And I was like, wow, I have to somehow meet this guy or figure out who this guy is. So sure enough, I meet him, we end up studying for something, and then he ends up moving to Portland shortly after he finishes up there, and got a job at Portland State and is still, I mean, we can see Portland State from right here, he still works there. Anyway, 5 years ago it started this press. What was your original question?
I was asking you about like getting feedback, right?
Oh, sure.
And so, I mean, I'm sure there was some form of feedback before him, but I would then ask like, oh, how did you meet your editor?
Right. So that's how I met my editor. But my feedback loop now is I kind of have a tiered system of readership where I have these first readers that I send to. My wife is the first one because she is brutally honest and says, this whole dialogue right here is the absolute worst, which is great to hear because you don't want anything going to your next series of readers that's garbage, because I think to myself, you can only get a first read on something one time. And when you read a thing for a second time, it'll never be the same as the very first time you read it. So every time I give something to somebody for the first time, I want it to be almost as polished and as great as I can make it. So I send it first to a couple readers that I would consider readers only and not writers, because I want a reader's feedback before I run a writer's feedback, because writer's feedback will be writerly. It'll
interesting.
It'll hone in on the sentences. It'll hone in on the structure. It'll hone in on the denouement, all of that. Like we're all trained in this sort of thing. So
the je t'aime, mise en scène.
Yeah.
The a la carte for sure.
The a la carte, especially
as a fellow writer, I know it's the worst when you get that from the
I know what you're saying.
From your peers of authors.
You want someone to read it for the first time who's just going to get a general sense of it and an emotional kind of first reaction to it. And that'll tell you a lot more, maybe important information about the piece than if someone were to critique it on a more microscopic level.
Yeah, you write it for readers. You don't write it for writers. I mean, design. It's just like film.
You're making a film for a viewer. You're making design for the customer or whoever is seeing the design. And Vince, for example, you read my book, but the chances that you're probably going to go reread that are slim. I mean, I would be honored, but why? How
are they, Vince?
Yeah.
So, 1 to 10. What do you think about the book?
I really enjoyed
great
it.
Feedback.
And we've reflected on the show a lot about how we both appreciate brevity and having something wrapped up in a nice tight package. And I think this book was a really good example of that. I borrowed it from a friend of mine and a friend of the show, Elliot Mattson, which is actually how I heard about Evan.
So you didn't support the artist?
Yes,
then.
You did. You read my book. That is, I think
on.
About this.
No,
a lot
it was a trick. I was giving him a platform to talk about this, Vince.
Oh, well, I have a platform for that. Thank you for asking. No, you had talked about just the feedback loop and the artist as business owner, really branding oneself. And I always think to myself, even if the book, if you're not selling a book, but somebody's reading the book, that's the thing that's going to make the book sell.
That's very much an idea virus idea, like Seth Godin. It's like, give it away for free, and if it spreads, you know.
Well, people last night at the reading, they said, oh, bring your book and sell it. And so they asked, how much do you want to sell the book for? And I said, no one who wants this book shall walk away without the book. So whatever, if they don't have any money and they want this book, let them please have that book.
Ah, the pay what you want model is very radio ad.
What's that throwback to 2008?
Rainbows?
Yep,
yeah,
I think you're right.
I think, yeah.
So what
would you pay for the book, Vince?
That's a great question.
I think it's easily a $10 book.
That's not bad.
I only need to sell
1 million of them.
I was going to say, what's your address? And Vince will send you a check.
This is just putting me in an entrapped position. I liked the book. I would love to support
Evan. I'm a big
fan
of entrapment also.
I'll tell you, one of the strangest experiences I ever had was riding the city bus here in Portland and seeing somebody else on the book. On the bus reading
Whoa.
My book.
That's awesome. That's
it was pretty
awesome,
eerie.
Man.
I kind of
that's amazing.
Didn't
want
to watch, but then
I'm
going
to go ahead and cheers
to
you.
Yes.
Wow, that's fun. That was
way to make me jealous again every time of the fact that you're in Portland with the guest and I am sitting here alone in my apartment. One thing I did want to hit on before we kind of start to transition to the second half of the program is we'd be remiss if we didn't hit on an old 10,000 hours classic about when in the process, when in the point A to B, do you first introduce the feedback?
And we both have pretty specific opinions on this.
We do. I mean, in general, I think we both agree with the fact sooner is better as a formula.
Yeah.
Like, bring me something crappy on day one instead of something hopefully good on day nine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've preached that a bunch. But it's also the point of, like, do you get feedback at the idea stage when you have the concept in mind before you have anything on paper? Or do you get feedback after the first draft early on? Or do you get feedback after you have a whole product, even if it's not in its finished form? And I mean, you described your process with your first book, Evan, where it was like a chapter by chapter, very rough feedback process. And that was kind of how it even formed as
although,
a finished
like shenanigans
product.
Feedback.
Yeah, it was
coerced. Perfect aces, man. This is the best.
100% next chapter.
How do you like? What does your feed? What's your feedback process going to look like for this next project?
You know, so as I go about writing each of these short stories, I kind of don't solicit any feedback until I myself am kind of behind it. Like, it takes me a while. I kind of get going, and sometimes I'll kill the project. I'll kill the story before it gets too far. And I think, you know, either this has got to become something different, or I have to change the narrator, or I have to, I mean, I, you know what? I'll do a classic Grant and I'll back up and I'll
say, already back. Just met him.
You know
I
what I do when I write? I save each draft with the title and the date.
You do sound like my kind of dude right now.
Because I never want to lose any work that I may have done in a previous iteration. And so because I know
until
it's done, and that's another program I know, like, when is it done? I kind of consider it when it's published and it's out there, and I don't mean, I mean, if it's in a journal and then it gets collected into a book, I recognize you have another opportunity to edit at that point. But once it's kind of in a book and it's out there, unless you're doing something bold where you're saying, I want to go back and revisit this Blade Runner style. Like, here's the ending I actually wanted to make, but my director or my whatever producer didn't allow me to do that. Unless you're doing something like that, I kind of think it's published. It's kind of,
it does seem to be printed at that point.
I mean, it's not digital. You're not going to update it or refresh it. I mean, you could
physically go in there, rip out pages and sort of make additions.
Now you're talking,
but
my
that
style.
Doesn't seem very practical.
I mean, and there are new versions of books that come out that correct the typos. They maybe change some things.
Actually, you know what? I've experienced this. In college, what they do is they'll do the third edition of a book. And it's really amazing. What they'll do is they'll take out a couple words, and then they'll put maybe a new cover on it. Maybe not. And then they can charge a bunch of money for it.
$85 for that new book.
Because of all the additions. For each character that they added.
Yes.
Which was just like dots author stuff.
I'm familiar with this industry standard.
Yeah, this is super.
They had to change the copyright date, man. That's worth something.
Oh, yeah. And then they had to put it in Braille.
Of course, right.
And it has a CD-ROM that goes in the back.
Oh, yeah. CD-ROM?
When I was in college.
What is this thing?
Yeah, now they just like put a URL, honestly, in some things. Like, go to this URL to download the PDF version. But,
hey, Grant.
Oh, yeah.
Smooth transition. But do you think it's time that we.
It wasn't a smooth
transition was how unsmooth the transition
was.
Okay,
you were like, you were commenting on the transition. Like, you're saying smooth transition, but it was like sort of ironic, which is kind of cool because we're in Portland and it's sort of an ironic.
I think it's the irony capital of the United States.
You
I
call
would
it
be,
the irony
I think
hub.
I'm safe in saying.
Oh, it's the hub of irony. We're recording live from the irony hub of the United States.
So, Evan, I don't know if you're familiar, but each week we like to do a segment we call the off-topic topic. And basically it's just a way of breaking up the conversation with something that is a little bit tangential. And while we're on this 10,000 miles presented by 10,000 hours journey
nice.
In Portland, We are asking our guests one topic question that's the same across each of these guests.
Very cohesive. Excellent.
And it is to talk about the idea of home.
Okay.
So, I mean, in the most general sense,
take
of the
it
word,
away.
Yeah. It could be physical location. It could be more metaphorical.
I really think the question is like, what is home to you?
Yeah. What does home mean to you?
Oh, he's stroking his mustache. Well, no, okay, hold on. I lied. Now he is. But it looked like you were going to stroke your mustache. I jumped the gun there.
Home to me, first and foremost, is Judith, my wife. And wherever she is, that's where I kind of consider my home. And right now, in the past year and a half, we purchased our very first home in the Monta Villa neighborhood of Portland. And we... Montevilla.
I was saying with the Costa Rican sort of accent, the double L is more of a J. So just to clarify.
We did something, I don't know if it's necessarily, especially in Portland, untraditional, but we tore into the yard and ripped up all of our lawn and put in 16 raised beds in order to try to grow as much food as we possibly can our house.
I honestly thought you meant like beds.
No, raised beds, garden beds. They're just beds outside. It's like Airbnb, but outside.
Oh, yeah, same thing. And actually, I mean, if I may, I think this is something I hadn't considered before, but this is an interesting point to comment on it. When you first said that, I swear where my head went was like to provide beds for people who don't have them. And I was like, because honestly, man, the level of homelessness here is, I guess maybe it's, I don't know what it is comparatively.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely higher.
It is. And I even know why. It's because the services here provided in Portland are very, very, very good.
Top-notch.
And then it rarely is below freezing here.
Yeah, it's just the weather.
And right? The weather's really good. And so there's a lot of.
Totally. Yeah, that makes sense. But it's like you are very much faced with it. And it's, we don't have to like dig into where you stand on like supporting homelessness or like supporting people in that current state or like, you know, all of those things. But regardless of where you stand, I think it's definitely a pretty intense reminder, you know, of sort of, I mean, to be thankful for what you have.
Absolutely.
And it's all, yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's oh man, I don't know. It's not to overblow it, but when it's so apparent, when you see suffering right in front of you, it's like pretty intense. So.
And suffering that's tied to this idea of home is, it's like when we were in Portland, I think at least I learned that the city itself has a very thoughtful and in my estimation, refreshing view on homelessness and how to kind of mitigate the suffering of that part of the population.
Well, and empower too.
Yeah,
I think,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think
absolutely.
Specifically of the, it's in the Pearl District, is mm-hmm. it? What is, you know what it's called? A dare to dream? Something. It's basically a home, like a facility run by homeless people.
Yeah, community.
Is that politically correct? Homeless people? I don't, I mean, I'm just curious.
It's
just curious.
Right?
Yeah. So anyway, but that was a cool project, I think. And it was kind of like, whoa, like this is a cool thing of like, oh, you know, people sort of owning this and trying to uplift each other.
And, you know, Vince, when you bring up that is something that Portland has really attempted to do, I think one of the things that I like most about having deliberately chosen this as my home, because when you, I don't know if you two own homes, but when you decide to buy a home, that's a really astronomically big decision, at least for me.
Yeah,
I mean,
oh,
I,
absolutely.
In my first
no
home
argument.
And it's like, wow,
charging
you're going
right?
to, this is a lot of money. This is a lot of paperwork. This is a lot of commitment. And where do we want to do
that?
Yeah. I actually have it all in an old school file cabinet, but.
Good. And you'll compost it though at the end, right?
We'll put it in the compost bin and feed it to
classic.
But I had to think like long and hard, and this kind of comes full circle, A to B. The Powells was the reason I wanted to move here.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
I came and I had visited, and it was rainy and it was book oriented. And the Vince, you had said like they're kind of the city. the city has a little motto, and it says "The City That Works," which is kind of ironic because there's a lot of people
awesome.
Here who don't work a ton, and there's the whole spoof, obviously, of Portlandia,
yeah,
where
yeah.
people go to retire early. But they're toying with this double entendre of the city that's actually working well as a city with these services, or with what I love is
it
I love driving down the street.
Right?
What's that?
As a community, as more so than a lot of places.
They're just building, I think, the 11th or 12th bridge over the Willamette River that spans southwest and northwest. We're now sitting in the southwest quadrant of the city, goes across the Willamette. And this bridge is only for and will only be for buses, pedestrians, and cyclists. They say this bridge is specifically for this sort of progressive automotive or our, this transportational thoughtfulness.
Unicyclists.
Unicyclists.
Included.
They have...
Recumbent bicycles.
They have a...
that really is, though. I mean, that like not to belittle that. Like, seriously, it is like very progressive. I mean,
very progressive. And I love living in a city where they're like, you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna build this bridge that only these people can go on.
Like,
you try that in Cleveland.
It's like it's the equivalent of carpool lane, right? I mean, it, like the next version.
Yeah,
it lets incentivize a good behavior that is like positive for the environment and for our city.
They have a world class, I mean, within, if this house wasn't here, we could see Oregon Health Sciences University, which sits up on this hill, and they noticed that so many people were going to work up at this hospital that's world class every day, that the traffic was so terrible, they decided to make a tram from down by the river up to the hospital so that people could get to it every single day. And I thought, I want to go live in a city that's making those sorts of decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than in Colorado, where I'm sitting there and you're on Interstate 25 between Fort Collins and Denver. And I'm like, how is it that this many thousands and thousands of people are on this road every day and they cannot decide to just put in a commuter train? Like, how is that your mentality? So I just love living in a city and choosing. I deliberately chose a home that would kind of be that way, I guess.
Totally. I mean, the fact that Chuck lives here, and actually, like, I honestly kind of want to go try and see.
Try to find Chuck E. Peas right here.
Yeah, I'm going to. So I'll report back on that. But but really, to me, I think what home represents is a sense of safety, a sense of comfort, a sense of, oftentimes for me, like inspiration or like permission to create. That's really when I do feel most at home, is when I'm making stuff. And so that could be in a lot of places when I'm in that sort of zone.
And it could also not be in a lot of places.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever tried living somewhere where you just kind of don't, it doesn't really work with who you are.
Right.
I don't know. I lived on the East Coast for a couple of years and I just noticed I'm from
You're
basically,
West Coast
yeah,
boy.
I'm a Westie
You're
person.
Westie. You're,
I mean, you had mentioned Vince
Westie.
Being from the Midwest and what that kind of means for your personhood.
He seems sort of, I don't know, you seem more Canadian than anything, Vince.
Vince, are
Me?
You secretly Canadian?
Yeah.
Am I Canadian?
Are you secretly Canadian?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know we know you're not technically, but.
I think that is both flattering to me and a bit disrespectful to Canadians. Like, I don't think there's anything about my personality that strikes
No,
myself.
I would say if anything, it would be like German.
Ooh, okay. I'm on board with that. They're a little bit austere for my taste.
Yeah. But like, I think like if you were true German, you'd be just as austere.
So. Maybe so. My lineage is actually mostly Czech.
Yeah. Of course, Kochi is his last name.
Yeah, the Slavic lands. And to me, I think just comment on this like idea of your city as your home in some respects, like I definitely feel like it's not just a matter of nature versus nurture, if this is like a conversation even worth having. Like, there are certain cities that I felt like I could instantly move there tomorrow and call it my home, and I think Portland is one of those cities. And then there are certain cities that I could never see myself truly feeling comfortable in. An example of that would be San Francisco. And so I think what the point I'm trying to make is that, of course, I mean, of course, different personality types fit in different places, but whether it's on a micro, right, different strokes for different.
I see you change the words around a bit, though. That was good.
But on a microscopic level, even like a location in your house, to a larger level, the type of house that you buy and what neighborhood it's in, to a larger scale of where on this earth that you live, finding somewhere that is cohesive to your personality and the way that you work and live and love is important, and it'll make you a lot happier if you can mix and match that up.
Word, word, word.
I mean, and we would be remiss if we did not say that that is a...
We'd be triple remiss.
We really would. if we didn't admit that that's a luxury to be able to find.
Word. Like, I mean, I think that's kind of what I was getting
true.
To with. Like,
very true.
Like, that was like a super stark reminder of the sense of home. And even to say, though, that like even without a physical home, and that's an incredible luxury and an incredible privilege, and that's not to say that we don't work hard, but it is very lucky. I mean, just the amount of circumstances that lead to that. And it is a reminder too to say that just because one doesn't have a physical home doesn't mean I should prejudice them and say that they don't have one, because they very well may. You have a home in Judith. You know, if you didn't have a roof, that doesn't mean you don't have a home, right? So, but
that's a great point.
Really,
having a physical shelter is one thing. It's extremely, you know, important, and we're extremely lucky to be able to kind of write that off as a given. But it's going to be incredibly cheesy, but home really is something more ephemeral.
It's where the heart is. Well, wait,
yeah,
the
exactly.
heart isn't ephemeral, though. Well, no, it is. I mean, human
yeah,
life
for sure.
is ephemeral.
For the idea of the heart is ephemeral. And you can find home in others, and you can find it in ideas. And I think it's something that we should keep in mind.
Yeah. Home is everywhere, and home is nowhere. But home is somewhere.
And yet I found
and
my
so
home
now
here.
The idea is completely constructed, and we can move on.
Oh, nice. Speaking of ephemerality.
Speaking of
ephemerality. And quick aside, ephemeral is actually my favorite word in the English language.
It's a great word to pick as a favorite, man.
Thank you.
I love it as
well. Based on The Little Prince, you're familiar?
I am quite familiar.
I figured. I think most writers are. Just it seems like
Now I would feel really stupid if I didn't know what you were talking about. You before you even heard my answer, you're like, oh yeah, most good writers know. Like
I didn't say. Whoa, you added the word good. I know where your angle is.
You qualified it.
Jeez, pal. Hey, listen, Vince, you know, insecurities are a real thing. If you're insecure about it, we can talk about it maybe
you're
off the show.
Man,
okay, so, Vince,
May I ask?
So, I'm going to just go ahead and transfer us kind of like your beautiful public transportation where you can go one place, you can transfer, you can go to another place. And we're partway. I say we're about 3/4 of the way through our ride, and now we're going to transfer onto that final line, that final stretch of track. Or
last stop.
Yes, we're headed home, and woof.
Doing great, man.
We like to end the show with two things. We have two questions. Okay, so there's going to be two.
Okay, I'm ready.
I'm just preparing your mind for this, and I'm going to tell you what they are in a second. And the first one is the question is, how can our listeners support you? You know, so where can they go URL wise, whatever. And just like, what sort of action could somebody take to support you?
Yes.
And then the second question is, what's one takeaway from the show? You know, what's one thing you want people to walk away from your episode, which is A to B, with?
All right. You ready for these answers?
Yeah, I'm ready. Vince, are you
really ready?
You're ready. You're ready. All right. I really like that question of how could somebody support me, because I don't know that I've actually been asked that question ever as a writer, because
you're a writer now.
I'm a writer and an author.
You're a writer and author.
At the end of this episode, I am both of these things.
Great.
So thank you for that, both of you.
Yeah.
But I've never been asked that question before, and I think it's a really poignant one to be asked. So I'm going to have to make up my answer on the spot, but it's probably going to be, first of all, I suppose, Elliot Mattson, in fact, who we discussed earlier, had created a website for me back in 2011, which is awesome.
Elliot, getting show noted.
Way to go, Elliot. And on that, I just kind of I put up any sort of upcoming events that I have or any sort of news that maybe – if I have a new publication out or a new short story showing somewhere, I guess
Powell's.
If it's at Powell's or if it's at Tell It Slant, like I had mentioned, or whatever.
Right, yeah. But I wouldn't go unless it was at Powell's.
Well, Powell's is the place.
I'm just kidding. Okay,
the Powell's.
The Powell's.
any case, maybe visit evanpschneider.com.
Mm-hmm. And we'll share notes that for you.
And then you can, from there, I have a link to Propeller Books, which, again, is the publisher of my first novel, A Simple Machine Like the Lever. You can buy it directly from the publisher. You could buy it on Powell's. And then there are other means.
Powell's?
It is, of course, at Powell's.
Sweet.
It's showcased often in on the end cap of the small press section,
end
which
cap,
I'm
homie.
Very excited about.
Oh, my God. Get represented.
And then there are other means that people use to procure books, I hear, on the internet. And they could do that as well.
Sorry.
And so I guess maybe to support me, you could just do that or look me up on social media. I am a very bad Twitterer. But if you want to tweet me or with me, we could.
Tweeter, yeah.
You can maybe show me how to do that. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Just all that stuff that all the smart, cool kids are doing right now, like
wow.
You all. So
wow.
Let's.
What's
help,
your
help,
handle, man? How can they
help me along? I am Evan P. Schneider
okay.
on
That's
Twitter.
Right. Consistency is good.
It is. What Facebook is also Facebook/ Evan P. Schneider, I would think.
/.
So
I would think.
Yeah, just all of
I would
all
hope,
of that.
But, you know, I don't know.
And I guess above all that, if you want to take a couple hours out of your life and read A Simple Machine Like the Lever, and if you like it, tell somebody else
really
about it.
I really do
recommend
it.
Could you quickly, now that we're pretty close to B, tell the listeners what that book is about?
I'm going to actually ask Vince to do it because I am
That's
really
beautiful.
I'm
I
really
love
bad
this.
At explaining the book because.
Oh, I heard rad. Like, because I was adjusting my headphones, I thought you said, "Oh, I'm really rad."
I'm really rad at that. No, Vince, can I put you on the spot and just ask you in three sentences, like, what's it about?
I'm going to give a very general overview because I don't want to give.
Hey,
much
listen,
away.
Don't tell us what you're going to tell us. Just tell us.
Basically, it's a man kind of describing his sort of interactions, his journeys through life, his sort of life moments. Kind of overlaid through the way that he does one simple thing, which is ride a bicycle. How
Evan?
Close was that to offensive in
Stop.
A description
hey,
of the
Vinny,
story?
Shut up.
Not at all. It was not at all offensive. I never know because it's got these different layers. This guy is
sure.
really deep in debt, and so he's trying very wholeheartedly to really rectify that situation. He feels terrible for having accrued all this debt. He wants to get out of it. And so he really takes some pretty drastic measures to take care of that. And the debt that he works at getting out of accrues him some other emotional and relationship debt, as
Such
you may
imagine.
Such is the
imagine. Balance of all things. You place your chips in one corner and then you take them from another.
Or as I always like to say, I remember my sister, one time when we were very young, we went Easter egg hunting and she got all the Easter eggs and then she was running back to show my mom and she tripped and fell on all of the Easter eggs and destroyed all of them. And I said, that's why you never put all your eggs in that one basket. But
yeah.
Anyway.
And I do want to
so
note,
I guess it's been a fine show and we'll end it there.
Actually, I do want to note though, Vince, that even though the character in this book overcomes some stuff, it's written with a good touch of humor in the form of dialogue and kind of dry wit. And I think, even though it's kind of a story about overcoming some things and facing challenges, it's not at all like a slog of a read at all. It's pretty light and enjoyable.
I just lost $10 to Evan. I actually bet him before the show. I said, I don't think Vince actually read the book. I think,
oh my God.
And so the whole time we were actually just leading up to him asking you to describe the book.
Yeah. Well, you're a bastard is always great.
Well, hey, whoa. And that's one way you can support Evan is to make wagers with him that he wins. So, okay. On that note, what do you want to leave the listeners with? What do you want to exit them with? What do you want to place in there? So they've got a basket full of eggs. What do you want to put in there? You want to drop more wisdom? You want to drop more eggs? Is there wisdom in the eggs? What's in there?
I'm just going to abandon the entire Easter egg metaphor.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of came at you pretty hard about that.
It's probably not the best time to bring it up
I did. I do a lot of pun sort of stuff, and then what I do is I'm a big hypocrite. So that's kind of like my game.
No, I liked the I like the idea that this whole A to B and how to get started, and are you started or are you not started? So if I wanted to leave anybody with anything, I read a quote recently that I'm going to butcher and I'm just going to try to give you the essence of, but it was, if you have a thing that you want to do, and the major boundary between you and accomplishing that goal or that project or whatever is time, why don't you go ahead and try to do that anyway? Because time is going to pass no matter what. So if time is going to pass no matter what, why don't you at least try to do this thing that's going to take a lot of time? And so if you just put in, I think if you just put in the effort, I'm not going to promise, nor would anybody probably, that amazing results are going to come out, or that this and that and whatever. But if you really diligently and thoughtfully apply your thoughts and your efforts and your time in a particular way that has some thought behind it, if you think you're at A and you want to get to B, make a mental map and then just start that journey.
That's real nice. And actually, just to jump from that, I would say, you know, you don't want to make any promises about what you're going to get out of this, but what I will say, and I will promise this, is that you, if you're even thinking about the thing, you're already past A, okay? Because A starts somewhere that you most times, you know, we talk about, like, the nucleus or the genesis of the project. We can only see that in hindsight. You never really see that in the present. And I will say that what exists between the attempt to get from wherever you're at to B is learning, and it's incredibly valuable. It's one of the most valuable things. And I think that trying to accomplish something is one of the easiest ways to hold up a mirror to yourself and become more self-aware about what you're doing and about what you're trying to do. And I think it's one of the best things you can do. And that might mean failure. That might mean, you know, some shitty feelings. But the reality is, like, you're never going to get to B unless you try and get to B, at least in some way or another. Because as much as I say you only see A in hindsight, you don't really see B, quote unquote, in hindsight. It takes some foresight. So I would just recommend that anybody who wants to do something, try and do it, because you're going to get something out of it. And then also keep in mind that whatever you think B is actually like 8 miles down the road. And so, you know, just like you use the metaphor of the full summit, just keep that in mind. Keep in mind that you can see the summit from really far away, but as you get closer, it gets harder. But, you know, that's, if we were to apply a poker mentality to this, that's pot committed. If you're going to bet $1 million on something and you've already bet $900,000, right? You only have $1 million in your bank to fold at that point is really silly. So see the thing through and try and get to B. And even if you lose the hand, you win a bunch of other shit.
That's right, man. Wow. Well said. And can I just say that this has been a top-notch show in terms of metaphors? The metaphor game has been wild.
Do we have somebody counting them somewhere?
Yeah, I'd like to see that. So,
we have an intern for that?
Yeah. Well, we don't like to use the term intern.
Oh, I see. Nice.
Yeah, we'll have our production assistants go through and count the metaphors and write a detailed synopsis of each.
We'll show notes.
We'll have a pull-down menu of...
Yeah, it's going to be, you have to pull it down, physical pull down menu that we'll mail out to all the listeners.
Hey, Evan, thank you so much, man. This has been an enlightening and fun conversation, and I appreciate, again, taking the time to meet with us. It's too bad I didn't get to meet you in person. I'm jealous of Grant in that regard, but it turned out to be a great conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I'm sure at some point in the future, Vince, I will meet you in person.
I hope that's true, man. I'm looking forward to it.
But not like in person, like metaphorically in person.
No, no metaphors here. Actually, person to person.
How long can you stay out there, Grant?
Right. So, I mean, yeah. But, I mean, what is really person to person? I mean, like, that's a whole other show topic. But I think for now, you know, signing off from Portland. We don't say signing off. Yeah, I think, Vin, let's ship it.
Ship it. Can we get a ship it, Evan?
Ship it.
There's a lot of SH. There's a lot of SH. I don't.
Well, my last name is Schneider.
Schneider shipped it.
Yeah, exactly.
We're good.
You put the C in the ship it. Hey, Evan, thanks so much, man.